Hello and welcome to another Tubular Tuesday evening where I, Alex Jones, am joined by my co-host with the most. It is the one and only Jamie. Jamie, how the hell are you doing, brother?
I'm doing very well, thank you, sir. I'm trying to determine the origin of Tubular Tuesday. I feel like I should know it, but I don't. Is that another Bill and Ted? Because that's what you were doing before the show started.
It's a bit of Bill and Ted. A little bit. Tubular. That's what they say.
If anyone wanted an insight into where Jonesy's head was coming into this week's episode and what we're going to have to expect quotes from for the next 90 minutes, you've laid down the mantle. Thank you.
I have. If there were more than one person in the chat, Brimstone, shout out, I would play 20 questions as they do in Bill and Ted. But I'm not going to because I think that'd be unfair of only one person. However, I will stop to say that we are a gaming podcast. This is The Super Show, and you're joining us on YouTube possibly right now, or you might be joining us on podcasting platforms if you're watching this after the fact, where we are on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, all the best places to catch your podcasts. And we're also on paisleyradio.com, Thursdays 10 p.m, Mondays repeated 10 p.m. It is amazing to have you all here as we go over the week, the week's news, even though it has been a little bit dry. It's not been the best because we're leading up to Jamie. We're leading up to that amazing sort of like summer season when all the big news drops. So everyone's probably reining in a little bit. They don't want to give anything away at the moment. They want to give away too much in the run up. But we do have a couple of news stories that we're going to touch on. We're going to be talking a bit about the new Star Wars Outlaws story trailer, which just dropped. We're also going to be talking a bit about Senua's Saga Hellblade 2. And we're going to talk about Apple and the fact they've changed the App Store policy so you can now emulate retro games consoles, which could be epic. But
could also be shit.
Could also be shit. Let's get into our first news story, which, as I said, is the news that there is a new Star Wars Outlaws trailer that we have. Do you know what? I've only just watched it today, in the last hour. Well, I think it came out today. It's pretty hot and fresh.
Yeah.
It gave us a bit more of a look at the story, is what we'd be hoping from a story trailer. We know a little bit more about the main character and about what she's going to be doing. Let me get your first thoughts, first reactions to the trailer.
Yeah, I'm pretty encouraged by it. It's interesting. You and I were talking before we went live about some of our reactions to seeing the game debut at the Ubisoft Forward coming up on a year ago now. And it was a solid debut in some respects. I'd say it was a solid debut on paper, perhaps a slightly shakier debut actually in practice, in the sense that it was the promise of this open world, third person action adventure Star Wars game, and one with a focus on other kinds of combat that actually strayed away from sort of, like, let's say, lightsaber driven combat that we've seen in the Star Wars Jedi series. And of course, Ubisoft, don't get me wrong, I know a lot of people don't trust them to handle IPs like this, and there's a lot of good reasons for that, whether it's because of whether it's from a development perspective, and a lot of people still have weird hangovers from whether they don't like the directions that series took, like, you know, Assassin's Creed, or whether they don't like the way certain games are marketed, or not marketed, as the case may be. Who remembers that an Avatar game came out 4 months ago? Very few, not many people. So I understand why some people are a little bit skeptical, but I thought the blueprint seemed solid and it felt like a Star Wars game we hadn't seen before. In the same way that when you saw Hogwarts Legacy for the first time, you were like, this is an obvious slam dunk in terms of game formats and formulas for fans of that series. Outlaws had that going for it. I think you described the gameplay showcase we got last year when we were chatting just now as looking pretty on rails. Yes. And I would also echo that sentiment. And in that sense, I feel like I am maybe another trailer away from being fully on board the Star Wars Outlaws hype train. That being said, I think this was a solid trailer as far as an introduction to K-Vass goes. I mean, don't get me wrong, a lot of the story setup sounds extremely Star Wars. And, you know, there were obvious attempts within this trailer, whether it was with Jabba the Hutt or the Han Solo stuck in the... What kind of mineral is it he's cast in?
I want to say carbonite. Is it carbonite?
If that's the word that came to mind, I trust you, because you seem like the kind of person who would know.
I think it's something like carbonite. But no, hey, look, you touch on the events that unfold in the trailer. Let me just give the a little rundown for people that aren't in the know, if you don't know too much about Star Wars Outlaws. So it is in development by Ubisoft Massive, and it is going to tell the story, as Jamie said, of Kay Vass, a scoundrel who takes on jobs from various syndicates and recruits an outlaw crew to pull off a massive heist. So far, so Han Solo, as I'm sure won't be surprised at looking at the trailer, is very Han Solo heavy, which I suppose is a good thing. The one thing that from the trailer that got me was maybe it's a little too Han Solo. I don't really want them just to do a carbon copy, no pun intended, of Han Solo and then tell the same story. So I'm hoping they don't follow too closely Han as a character.
I agree. And I think one thing that's going to be an interesting kind of platform for them to work with in that sense is that when other video game series outside of the realm of Star Wars have taken their sort of their swipe at an Han Solo-esque character, in the sense that someone's a bit of, like you said, a scoundrel, a bit swashbuckly, a bit happy-go-lucky, to, you know, Nathan Drake is the first name that comes to mind. We've seen a lot of those characters or characters that as of that ilk in the past, functioning within linear action-adventure games, where you can create these very dynamic, you know, set-piece-driven story moments. I think what's going to be interesting about Outlaws is, if you go back to last summer, they were touting it, and some people beg to differ, but they at least touted it as the first-ever open-world Star Wars game. So there are some elements there where I'm like, well, that lends itself to certain kind of way of thinking or imagining the game design and how it might function. You know, it becomes a lot harder to tell one of those traditional Star Wars stories. And again, a lot of the kind of the set pieces that you'd naturally assume you'd be funneled towards, as we saw, you know, that were very much still there in, for example, the Star Wars Jedi series, are not as heavily associated with the open world formula, where things are a little bit more freeform. And of course, you talk about Ubisoft and open world in the same sentence, people's minds gravitate towards Assassin's Creed, towards Watch Dogs, towards Ghost Recon. Obviously, when you talk about Ubisoft Massive, you're thinking about, they ironically did work on the Avatar game that I just mentioned, but also they were the Division team. Julian Geraghty, one of the chief creatives on the Division 2, heavily involved in this, leading the project, I believe. So again, it's weird because I don't know how that those two elements almost clash in my mind. The idea of a Star Wars, a traditional Star Wars experience led by a Han Solo-esque character and the Ubisoft open world formula. I don't know how they mesh. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Like it. I think the problem is when as you, I think you said it, right? You're used to the sort of Nathan Drake kind of character in a much more linear experience where you can sort of construct the narrative and the levels in order to really drive the story along. And I think another game that really did that well for me was something like The Last of Us, where you, whilst it wasn't it didn't feel massively linear in some respects, like they tried to use the illusion of like hub world or open world or something. Sure. in some capacity, you were very obviously still following like quite a linear path, and I think that was really important for world building, for the fact that the developers could really focus your kind of focus your view, like if you're making a film, right, and you've got your director of photography, they know like the vista you're going to be looking at. They can make it incredibly cinematic. And when you think Star Wars, you're thinking like incredibly cinematic, as you know, the way that they're going to be putting this game together is obviously going to try and match the look and the feel of a Star Wars game. And as soon as you go open world, I think the problem you have is anyone can look at this game from any angle they want if it was truly open world. So yeah, to my mind, I'm kind of like, this is going to be open world in the same way that like Jedi Survivor is open world, insofar as it's not. I think a lot of it's going to be, okay. I think I don't want to be, make stuff up. I don't want to be mean about it, but I can see, I can see them having certain areas and elements that are where you're supposed to do the doings of the missions and things. Cool. And other areas are going to kind of be a bit empty, a bit kind of pointless, but it gives them the ability to say it's open world. If that makes sense.
Okay, yeah, it does make sense. Like,
maybe there's a hidden thing that around a corner in some rocks, but actually it's not really open world. We're not talking Red Dead Redemption 2 here. We're going to, I would argue.
Again, maybe Red Dead's a little bit sort of jumping off the deep end in terms of how the ambitions of this game. But again, it is interesting to go back to a lot of the marketing beats from this time last year. And again, they were very aggressively touting this as the first open world Star Wars game, in spite of the fact that some people pointed to games that had open world ideas. Well, exactly. And of course, they tried. Whilst we talked about that demo and how narrow a lot of the elements of that demo felt, but they at least tried to have that idea of them leaving the kind of the objective area that that mission was taking place in, and getting on that vehicle and going to a nearby town and getting on the bigger ship. So they tried to have that sense of kind of, hey, these are the distances you might be traversing. This is an idea of the of how a mission might play out. But I think, yeah, that's why I go back to the point that I think we both made now about needing to see another trailer, because a lot of open world game design nowadays hinges around the potential open-endedness with which one can approach a mission. And whether, I'm not necessarily talking about, recent conversations we've had about Dragon's Dogma 2, for example, and ideas of emergent gameplay, this idea of creating a set of systems and mechanics and then letting players mess around with them. Ubisoft do their own version of that, though, just in a very limited and narrow way. You know, that idea that every time you do come across an outpost, let's say, or an enemy encampment in an Assassin's Creed game or a Ghost Recon game or even a Watch Dogs game, there is that kind of slowed down procedural element of, okay, consider how you're going to approach this. You usually got some version of like a drone or an eagle that can give you some kind of an oversight and map out your way through an area. And then you're usually given, hopefully at least, very interesting set of gadgets, skills, abilities, whatever they end up being, to kind of put the onus back on the player to kind of create those moments and kind of get some systemic enjoyment out of the game. That's the part of the open world promise that Star Wars Outlaws hasn't shown us yet at all, because the slice that we saw June of last year could have, like you said, been lifted out of something that was extremely linear, which is why we probably still fall back to this idea that, well, it kind of looks like it might be. And the story trailer we saw today, whilst, it looked big and it looked expensive and it looked polished, and the visuals for the most part were quite strong. I think there were a few kind of slightly dodgy moments in terms of like performance capture and lip syncing and stuff like that. But otherwise, it looked quite pretty. But we haven't seen that side of the open world promise being even hinted at yet, which is why if this game does pop up again at the Ubisoft Forward, which I think it almost has to, if not before, as you suggested you might be hoping for earlier, then that's what we need to see next. That's the other part of this bargain that needs to be delivered on.
Yeah, let me completely backtrack and say, if this turns out to be a proper open world Star Wars game whereby you're effectively playing as Han before Luke and Leia, and you can get bounties from people and you can track people down in the open world and like bring them to justice or like and get money and stuff, and I would love that. Like, that to me sounds like an absolutely phenomenal Star Wars Outlaws game, which is exactly what this could be. I think the thing that's kind of worried me a little from what I've seen so far was as you've said multiple times, the on rails feel of the gameplay trailer that we saw last year, like I think it was 9 months ago, and this trailer that we saw now looked to me like a Jedi Survivor and I think those are, whilst they're hub world games, they're very linear narrative games that kind of go, no, but you can go and you can play around in these levels and you can do whatever. And that's absolutely true. But the actual story part of the game is very linear. There's not like any much to do. And I mean, not there's not much to do, but the game wants you to follow a specific path. And obviously with open world games, you want to really have the ability in some capacity to make your own game and make your own fun and do that sort of thing.
Right.
What I question, I suppose.
And because the Star Wars Jedi games, they also, for as big as those hubs can look when you, for example, open up the map for the first time, they also have the kind of like Metroidvania-esque, design decisions where,
right,
oh yeah, you can go a certain amount of the distance part through this path, and then you're going to come across a thing that you can't do because you can't double jump, and then you can't do that because you can't do this, and you can't do this, you can't get through these weird glowing green walls, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, it turned out I had to play the game for another 25 hours to get this ability to bypass, an obstacle that I found inside my first 3 hours of playing. I don't expect we'll see any of that in Outlaws. I guess the only thing I would say to, to some of your other concerns about the potential linearity of the game is that, yes, Disney have got a little bit more hot and heavy in recent years in terms of who they've licensed out some of their IP to, particularly when it comes to both Star Wars and Marvel, as we've discussed in recent weeks. But why would you, given their portfolio, partner up with Ubisoft for them to make anything other than the Ubisoft open world games they always make. Because even Avatar, like, again, to bring that game up, when you look past the fact that that game was kind of the slightly interesting choice to go for a first person perspective, and there was no option there to toggle that. And obviously there were, like I said at the time, you broke past the kind of the weird language and the presence of the Na'vi, and you're like, oh, a lot of these things are analogs for what you would expect to see in a Ubisoft open world game. And I think that's why that game nestled down as like a 7 or 8 out of 10, because there was nothing really wrong with it. It was just another one of those. I think Star Wars Outlaws is going to be that.
No, you're right. I mean, when you if you really boil Ubisoft down to what they're good at, and then you put those things together, you know, if you're talking Far Cry, Assassin's Creed, you do end up with the capacity to make a very good actual open world game where you're tracking people down and you're being an outlaw and you're, you know. But I don't know. There's more from what we've seen so far. I'm surprised with what we've seen so far. I thought we would have seen some more like Assassin's Creed style open world, like, this is a bustling city in on Tatooine where you're going to be pushing through the crowds and tracking someone. But we've not really seen any of that yet, which is, I suppose, I just find a little surprising. But as you said, Ubisoft Forward is confirmed to be on June 10th. And so we'll definitely see some more of the game then. It comes out on August 30th. So that if we don't see it before that, we'll definitely see some then for sure, because they're going to have to give us some more, Jamie. We need some more.
I think it's just that August 30th date feels a little soon. And I think if that August 30th date was like November, if it was November 30th, then we'd all be like, oh yeah, you know, come back in June and we'll rock and roll. That's fine. Especially because we've been trained, I don't know, for want of a better way of putting it, to sometimes go along to, if you'll excuse the very old verbiage, the E3-like shows, and seeing trailers for games that look either very ambitious or like a new direction for a studio, and saying, okay, they didn't even put a date on that trailer. That could be 5 years away.
Right.
We have gotten used to doing the heavy lifting on their part. So every time a studio does the opposite of that and was like, no, we unveiled that game and it's going to come out 14 months later, it's a pretty quick turnaround for an open world, again, allegedly the first open world Star Wars game.
The irony is as well, like, it doesn't feel like that long ago that we would have sort of said, you know, we would have decried games taking 5 years to come out, but we've almost got to the point now where if a game is anything less than 4 or 5 years, we're like, well, it's not going to be a proper game, is it? It's going to be like a half-ass phone it in because they've not taken long enough. But no, they absolutely can make a phenomenal game in that length of time.
I guess they can. It all depends on how much of the development was done prior to the announcement of the game. That's the key part of the equation that sometimes I think certain publishers drop their end of. And it's interesting. I think we're going to be talking about a game in a little bit that I think certain people are going to have certain expectations for based on how long we've known about it. And I think those people are going to be, if they set their ambitions and their expectations a little bit too high, slightly disappointed by the product we receive, just purely based on the circumstances around which it was announced, you know, promoted, publicized, and so on.
Let's move on in a sec. I just want to just say, as we've said, the Ubisoft Forward is going to be coming June 10th, but we can also expect to see their Assassin's Creed Red, X-Defiant, and maybe some Splinter Cell stuff, given that Ubisoft Toronto recently put the old Fisher Goggles as their banner on Meta, on Facebook.
It did.
Which is pretty sick.
I have to say, if that Splinter, and for anyone that hasn't forgotten, that is a Splinter Cell remake. Again, a remake of the first Splinter Cell game that was one of the games that was essentially announced very casually and very nonchalantly on Twitter amidst a push for hires and recruitment. So if that sounds like a weird name drop out of nowhere, that's why. But yeah, if Ubisoft Toronto have just changed their Facebook banner to the goggles, and that has nothing to do with what Ubisoft are planning to show us this summer, then that is cruel, in a word.
Very, very cruel. But hey, look, Star Wars wasn't the only game that we got to have a little bit more of a look at in the past week, because earlier in the week we also got a preview. Well, some people, I should say, got a preview of Senua's Saga Hellblade 2, which was from Xbox, which Xbox put out. So some outlets got their hands on. They got to play sort of like an hour's worth of that game and actually see what combat felt like, what puzzle solving felt like, and what it felt like to get back into the mind of Senua in that schizophrenic, terrifying, nightmarish environment that her mind can become.
Yeah.
I must admit, from what people were saying in the previews, I am super psyched, if I'm being honest. Also, a little bit, not worried isn't the right word, like I'm a little bit like downtrodden from where I thought I would be based on like previews and what people were saying. But don't let me sully you with my initial reactions.
You've got me second guessing my own sort of feelings on it.
Shall I set you up for why?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I suppose the things, when we come off the back of like the original, right? So I think it wasn't that surprising that we ended up with a game with a phenomenal story, a phenomenal way of presenting information, but then maybe the execution was a little bit lackluster when it came to things like combat. When it came to, like, the game looked fantastic, but I think some of the puzzles could have done with some work, which I think is fair to say. But it's always the way, I think, with new IP, it's always the way when someone's trying something new, because they have loads of ideas, and I think to get everything into one cohesive game first time round is not that easy. What I think we all like to see is when a second one is released, they polish up the rough areas and improve upon the areas that were already good, and you end up with like, wow, this is what the first game should have been, and we can all sing its praises. From some of the previous stuff that I got to sort of have a brief look at before the pod, it seemed like some people were saying that the story side of it is still fantastically strong, and they've doubled down on the presentation and that, and have made it look fantastic, and the story's fantastic, but maybe some of that combat and some of the puzzle solving is still a little bit rote. They maybe could have, and those are the weaker areas that I was hoping they would have done more work on.
Yeah, I agree with that, and especially obviously we haven't had hands-on with Hellblade to this stage. Very few people have, and that makes it a little bit difficult, because this is a game that lends itself so strongly towards that very cinematic level of presentation, where there's no HUD or anything like that. But sometimes its presentation is so seamless, you don't really know what you're actually watching and how hands-on those experiences are.
Right.
A big problem for the game in the years gone by, various trailers, because they tout everything.
The giant trailer. The original, yeah, exactly. with the Chuck and the Spears. We were like, this is amazing. Do you get to play this? Is this cutscene?
Yeah, what are we doing?
Yeah.
And it's funny, there are still some points where the camera kind of takes that slightly lower and to the side perspective, where you're like, oh, okay, I played the first Hellblade. That's what combat looks like. And you can identify that. But there are still some sequences like, where certain finishes are playing out and certain animations are playing out, and the tissue that kind of connects certain combat sequences, where I'm like, is that all gameplay? Anyway, regardless, it's all in engine and it's all very pretty. I think my problem with this game is that my problem with this game are the expectations I created for it myself, because whilst I think you very accurately outlined what one might hope for or from a traditional sequel, I allowed myself to believe that something bigger might take place here. And I think a lot of it was to do with the timings. That first Hellblade game came out in around 2017, I want to say, at least that initial release that ironically wasn't an Xbox at all at launch. Ninja Theory got bought by Xbox and Microsoft in 2018. So they are now 6 years into their working relationship together, and they haven't really done anything significant yet. I know there was that I always forget its name, but that sort of, I can't remember if it's 4v4 or 5v5 PvP character-based melee combat game. I think it was it Bleeding Edge, something like that.
I don't know. I'll have a look while you
a multiplayer only PvP melee game that's
Bleeding Edge, you're right. Yeah,
yeah, and it died very, very quickly, but it was a Ninja Theory game. If you put that to one side, this is us seeing, the fruits of Ninja Theory's labor. And the conversation for the entirety of the 6 years, and not all pinned on Ninja Theory, has been, okay, great, Xbox, you're acquiring all these studios, you're building up your kind of like your portfolio. That's fantastic. When are they going to start making the kind of games that you're splashing out all this cash for? When are we going to start seeing projects that we stop there and look at them and go, oh, that game got bankrolled by Microsoft or Xbox, in the same way we say about Sony and PlayStation.
Right. Yeah.
And when Hellblade 2 was announced at the Game Awards in 2019, Jonesy, alongside the announcement of the Xbox Series X,
So five years ago, we're talking.
Yeah, it's going to be coming up on five. It's coming up like towards the end of the year, it would hit 5 years. So it's, call it 4.5 by the time this game comes out. And again, announced alongside like the sort of next gen console, they're like what was then their next gen console. You were like, okay, this is what we always wanted to happen. This is what we wanted to happen with Undead Labs and with Playground and with all those studios. Xbox bought them. Xbox gave them a blank check, said, go away and make us a really fucking cool game. And they did that. And they took their sweet time. And the more of their sweet time they took, the more it almost fed into my own, you know, created version, right, my own headcanon for what Hellblade 2 was. And then we sat down at that, what do they call it? The developer direct or whatever it was at the start of the year. And a lot of us forgot about it because we were more focused on Avowed and especially Indiana Jones. They were the big talking points out of there. But we sat down and we watched Ninja Theory have their little segment and say, oh, by the way, this is a digital-only $50 game that's going to be about the same length as the first one and is, again, made up of Hellblade walking through, Senua walking through environments that are admittedly much prettier this time, solving puzzles that are probably going to be more complex this time and engaging in combat that might be a little bit deeper this time. But it's the hell. Do you know what it is? And maybe I might have to eat my words because what I will say is visually, it's very, very strong.
Yes.
But if you ignore the fact that visually it is quite as strong and takes as much advantage of Unreal Engine 5 as it does, this looks like a Hellblade 2 This looks like a Hellblade 2 that Ninja Theory could have made without Microsoft. And that's the bummer for me.
But I don't think you're wrong about that at all. Like, I think that would probably be my thing about, like, you know, they've totally continued down the same path. Story and visuals have all got fantastic, but with Microsoft money, I would have loved to have seen them really work on that combat system, really get some more, like, I mean, I'm probably totally wrong with the puzzle side of it. I'm from the preview stuff. It was someone playing it and saying, "Hey, I've done this before in Hellblade 1, and these puzzles seem very similar and not that, you know, not that revolutionary for the sequel." And so it could just be that actually, as you get into the game properly, it really does open up and you do get a lot more. But as we said, we know it's going to be a similar length. It's not going to be like really long or anything like that. I was hoping for more with Microsoft money because I've loved Ninja Theory for a long time. I used to like Heavenly Sword and Enslaved, Odyssey to the West. Absolutely loved those games. Yep. Fantastic.
Were you a DMC guy?
Not so much, but I was a little bit. I thought they're a fantastic developer. And when you hear like, oh wow, money, like Microsoft money, you're like, yeah, this is gonna take it stratospheric. But I'm totally with you. They've seemed to have gone stratospheric with the visuals, but they don't, and with the storytelling, but they just seem to have, maybe everything else is not quite done much, which is a bit of a shame. And I think you're right. Like there could be an argument made for this was the path they were already on, that Hellblade 2 could have been made with them out being bought by Microsoft, which is a bit of a shame. But maybe that's part of the thing, is that Microsoft don't go in all guns blazing and say we're going to revolutionize everything. Maybe they just give them space to make the game they want to make, and maybe that's a good thing.
I mean you go back to Arcane and Redfall, and that was what Phil was saying in the aftermath of that, was like, yeah, we stepped back, and because there were a lot of allegations of Microsoft pressuring Arcane to make, you know, like a more accessible game, to make a game that, you know, was this and was that, and like, and Phil was the one who said no. Actually, it was the opposite. Arcane made 100% the game that they wanted to make. We were the ones that took a step back, and actually, in some respects, he regretted taking a step back because Redfall was Redfall. So, you know, that suggests that in some respects, you know, Hellblade 2 is exactly the game that Ninja Theory wanted it to be, and maybe they had no ambitions for something bigger or something more ambitious. But then again, I look at how long it was in development for. And I don't want to get into tinfoil hat territory, but there's a part of me that has to wonder, like, did they at some point, like, did they prototype, like, some hub world elements? Did they prototype a side quest system? Did they think about, they must have had those conversations and then decided it didn't fit, and that's fine. But I'd be very curious to know, you know, in the 7 years it's been since since the first game, how we arrived at the point where Hellblade 2 is being promoted and priced as an experience that's remarkably similar.
Yeah, and it's funny as we're saying that, it made me think of Psychonauts 2 and how Psychonauts, what are they even called? Double Fine, were bought by Xbox, and they continued to, and they made the Psychonauts 2 game that they were already making. Like, it didn't suddenly make that game completely change in form or factor.
They just had a bit more time. They weren't crunching quite as hard at the end.
Exactly. So maybe it's more, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to like a complete sort of like throw the billions of dollars at the wall and see what sticks. But hey, we can wait until later in the year and see a bit more, hopefully, because Summer Game Fest is coming up, and Jeff Keighley, I'm sure, will love to show us some more stuff. So, you know, we never know what we're going to see.
Well, there we go. Hellblade will actually be out by Summer Game Fest.
Oh, God,
Hellblade is a May game, I want to say.
Wow,
late May.
Oh no, God, that's so true. It feels like we're almost in summer at the moment. I'm getting ahead of myself with the year. I know we're not actually there quite yet.
These publishers aren't helping you when they are all coming out and being like, "Get ready for our big summer showcases or whatever." Well, to be fair, some of them have done that. Others have had their dates leaked. So it's a mixture of publishers and insiders getting us ready for summer.
Right. That is true. Okay, but Hellblade 2 isn't completely without its... it's not controversy. Like, you know, it's not a controversial thing. But obviously, some gamers are going to get a little bit aggy because we have heard the confirmation that the game is going to have dynamic resolution and is going to be 30 FPS, which some people are not impressed by. Where do you come down on whether or not that's a... is that a deal breaker for you? I know it's not, but I'm gonna phrase it like that anyway.
No, it's not a deal breaker for me. I do think that something interesting is happening as the console generation rumbles on. In that it felt like we came storming out the gates with, hey, every game is gonna offer you. I'm gonna boil it down to, you know, levels that it never actually necessarily reached. But let's say, for the sake of argument, 4K 30 or like 1440p 60. Don't get me wrong, it was never exactly that, and there was a lot of dynamic resolution and a lot of upscaling and checkerboarding, and very few things, if anything, actually reached a native 4K. I understand that. But there were a lot of games at the launch, at the start of the generation, that were offering either 30 or 60, and those games are drying up. And like, we are going through a patch right now where, like, you look at even the most recent batch of releases, and like, Dragon's Dogma 2 took a lot of flack for its performance. Rise of the Ronin has a performance mode that doesn't deliver like a solid 60. And, you know, Xbox have suffered from that even more, especially on the console side of things. When you talk about Xbox Series X performance, again, the flagship console, you know, Redfall was a 30 FPS game. Starfield was, of course, famously a 30 FPS game. Now Hellblade 2 is going to be a 30 FPS game. And so I think there are some, there are definitely, I'm sure, on the Xbox side, some people who are very disappointed, especially, again, because not to fan the flames of what was once referred to as the console war. They might have been looking at PlayStation players, you know, playing things like Spider-Man 2 or what have you, and being like, oh, weird, they had the option to play that at 60 FPS if they wanted to. Horizon Forbidden West, and all these kind of next-gen games, sometimes even cross-gen games, in the case of those, and saying like, oh, what, they made it work. Why aren't our developers making it work? And I don't really know the answer to that. But at the same time, I'm not a snob about frame rate, especially not if the overall visual fidelity justifies the frame rate. And Hellblade 2 looks like it might be trending in that direction. I'm one of those people that if that 30 FPS is solid and the frame times are consistent and there's well implemented things like motion blur. I know some people are iffy on that subject, but I think it can help with the overall look and feel of a game that's running at a lower frame rate. Then I'm not going to turn up my nose at it, especially because I don't think we'll get, ironically, the longer the generation goes on, to claim my point, the less of a choice I think we're going to have. I think 30 FPS by the end of this generation will have re-established itself as the norm, as the demand and the push for better looking titles and more ambitious visuals continues to stretch development costs, and more games are just like, do you know what? That seemed like a relevant target at the start of the generation. It doesn't anymore. 50 million people bought GTA 6 and frame rates didn't come, the conversation didn't come up once. If Rockstar can have their game run at 24 frames a second on average, then ours can run at 30.
It seems so surprising that as well, because if you'd have gone back, say, 10 years and you just said, where are we going to be at at this point, you know, 2024, I think people would be like, oh, 8K, 120 frames at least. Otherwise, people will be losing their minds. But yeah, it's just not the case, right? It's dynamic resolution. It's 30 FPS, and it's getting pretty games out there, and again, games that people want to play because they look nice. As we do go through May and we get Hellblade 2, we're obviously then going to be pushing toward the summer, but there is speculation as well that Sony are going to sort of jump the gun a little bit and they're going to get a showcase out in May. They're going to be dropping maybe a Silent Hill 2 release date and maybe a Death Stranding 2 update, among some other speculations that it could be time, Jamie, for Ghost of Tsushima 2. Do you think we'll see Ghost of Tsushima 2?
I don't fucking know. Do you know what, Jonesy? Last year, this PlayStation showcase stung my bum so fucking badly. Like, there's a part of me that is even curious enough that I might go back to whichever episode it was last year and listen to my own reaction to that PlayStation showcase. For anyone that can't remember, it was the one where we went in going, oh, weird, that there are no PS5 games to get excited about. This is the showcase where they're going to get us excited about all the PS5 games that they've been secretly working on, and we're going to see Uncharted 3, and we're going to see a new God of War, and we're going to see Ghost of Tsushima 2 and the Uncharted multiplayer game, and we're going to see all, and there was none of it. There was like, actually, we're all about live service titles at the moment, so how do you guys feel about, I'm going to get their name, I did this last week, Fail Safe, Concord. I mean, Helldivers 2 ended up being a slam dunk, but we didn't know it at the time, and so on and so forth. And that has made me very cautious as to speculate as to what to hope for from a potential showcase next month, especially because the insider who revealed this information, Jeff Grubb, the guy who claimed to have heard something is coming, he said that he didn't know if it was going to be a showcase or a state of play. And when I hear that, I don't know if that's because he doesn't have the information all lined up, or if that's because Sony is still deciding on internally. But if a decision is still being made internally, then this can't be the big deal showcase that most PlayStation fans feel like they are due at one point or another. But like we're getting, like, let's be real, Jonesy, third party stuff aside, like, we're getting to that point where, like, by the time this showcase happens, like, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth has come out. Like, Stellar Blade has come out. Helldivers has come out. Sony have, like, they've by cutting the right deals and signing the right contracts, they've pieced together a passable H1. You know, let's call it. But we're now getting into not just the summer, but we're getting into the remainder of a year and years beyond that, where we're like, okay, other than like Failsafe and Concord,
what is there?
What are we getting excited about? We don't know. I don't know how close we are. I don't want to put any onus on Insomniac because, you know, we know that they're always working around the bend, and like Wolverine will come when it's ready and it's fine. And they kind of, in some respects, have to recover from the very difficult end of the year they had last year. But like, I wonder, like, how far away are we seeing, even if there are small projects and side projects from the Naughty Dogs and the Sony Santa Monicas and the Sucker Punches of the world, and Sony Bend to get mentioned every time this conversation happens, you know, a potential Astrobot that, you know, seems to always get rumored. I do really hope it's time for at least a couple of those. And if this ends up being a showcase with, you know, we know that third party support will be fairly strong, you know, even if we just get some of the Konami games that we've mentioned, like if it's Silent Hill 2 release date, Metal Gear Solid Delta. Is that what we're calling that game now? The Snake Eater remake. If that gets gameplay, for example, or gameplay in a release date, or gameplay in a release window or something. Death Stranding 2, again, maybe I don't know how, I don't know how much more we can show of that. We might need to be patient with it, but maybe a sip of that. And then, like,
it's funny that we're at that point with Death Stranding 2 where it's like, can we have something else? Like, we've had a lot of Death Stranding 2. Like, give us something else.
Like, that's the thing. Kojima's been great. Like,
that's not me having a go at Kojima. That's me saying Sony are flogging that at the moment.
No, that's me having a go at Kojima for being so good that he makes the other games we don't know about annoying.
Right. Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
Blue Point, you know, again, and it's been now, like, again, we're coming up on like 4 years of this generation. You did great work on that Demon's Souls remake. You were allowed to go off and do your own thing. I don't think 4 years is an unrealistic amount of time to go off and be able to work on your own project before you're under some pressure to say what you've been working on. And like, I don't know. This is very, armchair game developer of me. Not even armchair game developer. This is like armchair investor of me, which is even worse because they're the least knowledgeable people in the room. They just have the biggest wallets. But I don't know how you feel, Josie. I just really hope. I'm not going to let myself get my hopes up, but I really want this to be the summer showcase or whatever ends up being where Sony are like, you're right, we're sorry. Here's why you should be excited for the second half of this generation or the next chapter of this generation.
I hope it is as well. Like I think when we always think back to the summer where it was the big three, it was Spider-Man, it was Ghost of Tsushima, and it was The Last of Us. And I think we can think back on that, and that was amazing. But then you could think, oh, hey, they only need a big three, and everyone will change their attitude if that's the case. But then they need to bring it. And I don't know if that's that likely, but hey, remains to be seen.
You know what? Depressingly, I agree with you. I don't know how likely it is either.
But as we said, that's coming in May. But then we also have Xbox bringing their showcase around June 9th, according to The Verge. The big new twist this time is going to be that Xbox will be the home of Call of Duty, of course, following the merger with Activision, Blizzard King. Merger, acquisition, whatever the difference between those two terms is, I've got no idea. I suppose they bought it, so it's an acquisition, it's not a merger.
Yeah, I guess
they didn't join, they just consumed them.
Can I give a correction, by the way?
Yeah, sorry. Absolutely.
Oh, on myself. The game that I have been referring to as Failsafe is actually called Fair Games, with the S on the end of games being a dollar sign.
Fair Games. Okay. I thought it was Failsafe. That sounded right.
I don't know why I had Failsafe.
Maybe you've said it so many times, I just believed it.
It must be that. But the weird thing was, I was also adding the weird unnecessary S onto the end of Failsafes to make it sound weird, in the same way that Fair Games does that as well.
I remember Failsafes, though, and we talked about this. I thought, anyway, we talked about it at the time because it was weird to say, and it was like, why have they got an S on the end? But so that's a, what do you call it? Like, when you misremember something which isn't true.
The Mandela effect?
I think it's the Mandela effect. Thank you. There we go.
Yeah. We made our own little super show Mandela effect.
So is there no game called Failsafes? If there is,
I googled Failsafe game and it doesn't look like there is.
We need to make a game called Failsafe.
Some guy called Bob DeCrescenzo made a new Atari 7800 homebrew game called Failsafe.
That's it. We're making a game, everyone. It's called Failsafes. It's going to be about coming out 2044. So get ready. Get ready for Failsafe.
Failsafe. There was a film in 1964 and in 2000 called Failsafe. There's a rock band called Failsafe.
That is so weird. Anyway,
there's a character in Destiny called Failsafe.
Let's move on from this made-up game.
Sorry.
So Call of Duty, the next, is expected to be called Black Ops Gulf War, and will likely debut prior to the show, to that June 9th Xbox showcase, before having a traditional gameplay showcase at Xbox, and then imagine it'd be everywhere after that. Other rumors are thin on the ground, but it looks like should be Avowed, Indiana Jones, and a potential return for Gears of War with Gears of War 6. So all of those to look forward to as we push into that Summer Game Fest era, as the new E3, as E3 is no more.
I forgot to make a note of it, but I also... I was very happy to get a trailer for Fable last year's showcase. It was nice to see a little bit more of the kind of the vision on that, and I'd be really excited to see more, even if it was another trailer, another in-engine trailer that would just sort of like, you know, explore the world a little bit more, or just, you know, open up a little bit more in terms of what Playground's vision is for that franchise. I'm very invested in that, and I also. Gears 6, I think that could be rad. Big Gears fan. It will be weird seeing Call of Duty doing its thing on an Xbox show. That it's been some years since we've been able to say that, but I guess that's what you get when you spend hundreds of billions of dollars, right, Jonesy? You have to tell the world about how this one is also going to have an open world campaign, but it won't be bad.
You do. Yes, that's the joy of having the money. But do you know what the joy about having this podcast is, Jamie?
What is it?
It's that we get to shout out some awesome people, and we get to talk about some people that that join us and listen to us chatting absolute rubbish about video games and some pertinent things about video games. But before we get into those people, I would just like to give a shout out to some of the people that have joined us today in chat. Shout out to Brimstone, Tech Nuovo, Jeremy Shirtleff, and Chris B. Thank you so much for joining in, for watching us live.
Tech Nuovo, eh?
Yeah, Steph kicking it there. I was resisting the urge to mention Rage 2 on multiple occasions when we were talking about open world games. I didn't, so you can
think about it, Steph. Yeah. Probably for the best. I have bad memories about those conversations.
But I would like to give a special shout out to some of our amazing patrons who have gone over to patreon.com/supershow, and they have put a little bit of the money down to support us, keep coming back week in and week out. You can go over there. If you put $2 down, you can join our Discord. And if you put $5 or more, you can get onto some extra content that you can watch. We've got some... I can't remember what we used to call them. We've not done anything for a while, but we're basically like the review thing. What's the review thing where we would sit down and argue about whether we liked a game?
Have we ever done that?
Yeah. Like a spoiler cast. There's a few old spoiler casts in there you could check out. You could also check out Known Murderer. There you go. There's a few old ATG tidbits in there as well. Some fun to be had. But there are some names on screen right now of some awesome people that have gone over there to support us. And I would also like to give a special shout out to Aaron Cameron, Athletic Gravy, Brimstone, Ice Nog Rock Salt, Jesper Camdar Nielsen, Pastors Guild, and the big dogs, the members of the board. I'm talking Bretzy, a.k.a. Shellshock, Geometric Potter, Hacksaw Begreed, Manuel Guerrero, and Peaswad. Thank you so much, guys, for supporting us, for people watching. And for everybody for, keeping our little train chugging along.
Absolutely.
Jamie, this is the point in the show where I say, what the hell have you been playing since I last spoke to you? Because I don't know, and I haven't spoken to you since.
It's true, actually.
Have you been playing anything?
I guess so. I've been playing a few things. I kind of keeping things like Dragon's Dogma ticking over. But... I don't know, I'm finding myself striving for a balance between, you know, the bigger games that I'm going to be playing for in a number of weeks and the smaller, slightly more bite-sized experiences. I talked about Open Roads last week, for example. They're kind of helping act as little palate cleansers throughout the week. And the one I opted for this week, which actually came out far earlier in the year than I remember, when I picked it up, I thought... Oh, weird, this is on sale and it's relatively affordable. It's somewhat for a recent game. I think it actually came out in January, but that's Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, which I know you yourself have also played, and so we had a chat about it at the time, so I won't bore people too much. I'll just say that I think it's really good. I really do. I think the Prince of Persia sort of series and the world and the art direction, so on and so forth, have adapted really nicely to that format. I think everything feels good. When it comes to sort of like the traversal and the combat, all the kind of not just the fundamentals, but also the directions and the ways in which they're expanded over the course of that game as you get kind of more abilities and so on and so forth. I'm picking up almost everything it's putting down. It can be a little bit frustrating at times.
Yes, agreed.
They're not even so much as difficulty spikes. It's just a game that can be a little bit unforgiving. And, you know, there are enemies, even like sort of relatively basic mobs, depending on which part of the map you're at or how deep in the game you are, that can really fuck you up if you just sort of stop paying attention even momentarily, if you get a little bit too overconfident. Likewise, there are some traversal challenges where you're like, I am fairly comfortable with 90% of what this game is asking me to do, and it feels like it just went from like 0 to 60 in terms of, to the point where I'm not even sure I'm going the right way. Am I going right. The wrong way, and that's why this is so hard? And that kind of taps into the only thing that I'm not sure about Prince of Persia, about this Prince of Persia game, and why I think The Lost Crown might not reach some of the upper echelons that Metroidvanias and 2D Retrovanias have reached in recent years. Like, for me, like the Ori games, for example, are still sort of the high point or thereabouts. I know it's, for some people, it's maybe like Metroid Dread. You and me both had sort of slightly differing opinions on that as well. But it's that when you combine occasional frustrations with the combat and the traversal, with occasionally a slightly finicky checkpointing system where it's not always clear how much progress you're going to lose or where you're going to respawn. Well, it's always clear where you're going to respawn, to be fair to the game. It does tell you that. But how much ground you might need to retread. And
it can be a little, it can be a little tedious when you die unexpectedly and you realize that you have to trek back over like 15 minutes worth of level that it really would be. And often your routes and your paths are a pain in the ass as well. Like, it's not a direct route to get back. It's through multiple maps, multiple areas, multiple enemies. And you're like, well, not one thing I don't like about that style of game, like the Metroidvania style of game, is when you get to the point where you sort of say, I can't be bothered to fight these enemies. I'm just going to run past and jump and dash and dodge and whatever I need to do.
Right.
Because then it feels like I'm doing busy work to get back to the point I was at 10 minutes ago.
Yes. And there is a fast travel system in there, but it never feels quite as elaborate or as convenient as such that, you know, you can circumvent a lot of these journeys. I've had weird situations where I've done like sort of 95% of an area and switched the game off or turned the console off, like, because maybe I need to do, like, I'm leaving the house in a hurry, let's say, without even thinking, like, oh shit, did I go to my like nearest tree or anything like that? And then turn it back on to find out I just sort of lost, like, you know, maybe 15-20 minutes, depending on how much I was getting stuck or how much trial and error there was. I might have lost 20 minutes of progress just because I wasn't thinking. And there aren't many games that put you through that nowadays. That's a weird, like, quality of life quirk that you don't expect from a game like this. And yeah, some of those elements just sort of like pile on top of each other and leave you feeling a little bit kind of leave you feeling a little bit more frustrated than you actually should. There's a weird thing that happens with that game. I don't know if you remember experiencing it during your time with it, but like, as gamers, when we're presented a path where one can either turn left or right, we're immediately angry because we're like, well, I don't know which way to go.
And so what we end up doing... What if I go the wrong way?
Exactly. And so what we hope instinctively is, I'm going to choose a direction. I'm going to hope I go the wrong way, because if I reach a dead end, I know that it's a dead end and I can then go back and go the right way, knowing the other way remains fully explored. Whereas if you pick the right way the first time, you're like, well, what was down the left? What if the left was a collectible that I... And there's a lot of that in this game where you're like going, I have to make a decision here about where I'm going, because right now I could go up, right, or down. And you pick a direction. And because the game is relatively flexible in terms of how a map can be progressed through, you're like, oh, I went the right way, I think. That's good in that, like, I'm fighting new enemies and I'm finding things and I haven't hit a dead end and I'm, you know, I haven't hit like a part where I don't have an ability that I need to overcome this traversal obstacle. But what was up and what was right, and when is there going to be a nice time for me to go back there and retrace my steps and see what was up and what was right? And sometimes you do go the wrong way. Sometimes you do go the wrong way far longer than you're usually allowed to go the wrong way for in games. So that there's some of that stuff that around the edges of The Lost Crown that was a little bit of a bummer. But the fundamentals are very strong. And cover your ears, Jonesy, but I do think this is a logical direction for the Prince of Persia series to have taken, considering, you know, how little love it had had for so long now.
No, I think you're right. Like, I was skeptical at first, but I think it's a very strong game. Really, really enjoyed. Well, I haven't finished it, but really enjoyed like the amount I played with it. One thing I found on top of what you said, I must admit, some of the boss fights were enjoyably difficult, and it took me a number of attempts to do. And I was like, okay, I can do this if I just grind out. If I just do this, I can do it. I then have encountered some bosses where I'm like, no. Like, there's literally no way I can, and I just have to leave. And I'm like, at some point in the future, I'll come back and do this, because it's just insane. Like, the difficulty spike is just so high that there's no way that I can overcome this at this point, which is a little bit frustrating. I don't necessarily like it when a game does that to you with a boss.
No, I agree.
But
like, I weirdly enough, I feel like in terms of balance, The Lost Crown almost peaks with the very first boss in the game. We're like, this is hard, this can be punishing, but if I'm patient with it, I can learn this pattern and that pattern, and you know, this phase and that phase. And after however many deaths, you get there. There are bosses later on that take it up a notch where you're like, I don't even know how to hit this thing.
I don't even know if it's physically possible for me to defeat this boss. And then after 10 tries, you're like, I don't think it's physically possible. And after 20, you're like, why do I keep doing this? And then, you go and do, and then you go do something else, which is frustrating.
Especially in a game with, to its defense, a lot of difficulty and accessibility options. But you don't always want to be the guy that goes like, well, this is the point where I take it down to easy and turn the parry window into extra large and all those kind of things.
No,
like,
can't do that.
Because the level of challenge the game presents you with for good chunks of the experience are super satisfying. And you get like those little, you know, those little boosts, those little sort of like endorphin hits or whatever they are when you overcome something, as, you know, is a very popular idea nowadays in games. But when it's taken too far, it sucks.
I think the frustrating thing about Prince of Persia as well is as you've said, like the difficulty go it for the platforming goes from like 0 to 60. But obviously there's outside of mechanics, which you haven't unlocked yet, you just have to get good in some respects with the platforming. And once you get good at it, you're like, oh yeah, this feels fantastic. Like I'm doing crazy jumps and leaps and combinations that I'm amazed that I can do. It's kind of frustrating when you realize that some of the bosses just simply aren't doable at whatever level you're at. Like you do need to go and get an extra power, get an extra kind of attack, you know, and balance some of that stuff a bit better and do some more sidey stuff to upgrade some of the other systems in the game, which I find a bit frustrating. I would rather those bosses were more like level gated before I actually managed to reach them and figure that out. I feel like Metroid Dread did that a lot better. I feel like any boss I came across didn't feel like it was insurmountable. It felt tough. It felt very challenging, and that I had to really, like, you know, develop my play style, but it didn't ever feel undoable. But I've definitely had that in boss fights with Prince of Persia.
Agreed. Yeah, Metroid Dread, it, like, felt really balanced across the board, and like even up to. That sort of some of the final bosses and the final boss in Metroid Dread, like you did have that some sort of air of helplessness at the very beginning, let's say the first death. But as you said, you know, in your example, by death 10 on a Metroid Dread boss, you were like, no, I know what I'm doing. And if I die, it's my fault.
Yes.
Because these are the rules and this is how it works. Whereas there is some, those are, fundamentally, that still applies to the Lost Crown. It just feels different. Doesn't feel as tight or as.
No.
Yeah.
No, agreed.
Jonesy, can I give you, and I promise this wasn't a segue that I planned, but can I give you a Prince of Persia exclusive?
You know you can.
No, what? No, I can.
You know you can. Go for it.
Oh, the you got cut off, so for me it was just you said, no, you can. this one didn't pick up as much traction, in spite of how cool it sounds, which is maybe why I didn't even think to kind of reference it as a potential news story for the podcast itself, but maybe it can be a late-breaking substitute for one if you want. And it comes from Insider Gaming and Tom Henderson, who...
good track
record. Not only does he have a pretty good track record, but he is also putting his money where his mouth is on some of the dates he thinks this is all going to play out on, because one of them is tomorrow at the time of recording. But a new Prince of Persia game is reportedly set to be revealed tomorrow on April 10th and releasing on May 14th into Steam Early Access.
New Prince of Persia. So we're not talking a new remake coming back.
This isn't the remake. This isn't DLC or an expansion for The Lost Crown. This is a new Prince of Persia game that is reportedly, and this might make or break it for you, a roguelike title that's been in development by Dead Cells studio Evil Empire for the past 4 years.
It's like you've just stabbed me in the heart, Jamie. There's not many words you could have said.
I'm sorry.
There's not many words you could have said after that, but the ones you chose were not good.
Hang on, though. Like, okay, let's break down the words I said. I'm guessing the sticking point for you, the word that you didn't like was roguelite.
And Dead Cells.
Dead Cells is one of the best, like, feeling 2D action games of all time.
Don't get me wrong, like Dead Cells is a fantastic encapsulation of a type of game that I don't like. Like, it's a fantastic game, but I'm being a bit mean. Like, there could be a lot. No, is Dead Cells the worst? It's not, and I'm not saying bad, I'm saying games that I've roguelike games that I've played that feel good, but then I'm like, damn, this game, I wish I liked this type of game, but I just don't. I just can't get on with
Hades?
It. Hades? I was going to say Hades is another one that comes to mind, but actually I had a better time with Hades than I did with Dead Cells. I had a better time with Hollow Knight than I did with Dead Cells. But it's just not, it's not a type for me. As the closest that I can get to, I think like the Metroidvania style in the 2D side-scrolling, you know, format, which is kind of similar in some respects to the to those, except it hasn't got the roguelike features.
Yeah,
I much prefer, because it's that more map reveal linear narrative version. Okay. Whereas the roguelikes, I just find it like Groundhog Day.
I mean, it kind of is by definition. That is the fundamental truth of.
But I feel like Bill Murray in the middle of Groundhog Day, whereas people I think who like roguelike games feel like Bill Murray at the end of Groundhog Day. But I feel like him in the middle when he keeps killing himself because he's had enough. That's how I feel when I play those games. I'm just like, see, I don't want to do this anymore, man. I'm getting the toaster. I'm in the bath. I'm done. I'm out. I'm falling off the top of the church. It's over.
Did you ever see Palm Springs, the Andy Samberg?
I did, yeah.
So for me, you say roguelike games are Groundhog Day. For me, roguelike games are Palm Springs, where like every single day I'm waking up, I'm immediately having sex with my girlfriend, who is having an affair, but I still get to have sex with her. I'm getting drunk. I'm finding out new ways to pick up someone from this wedding every single day. I'm creating like wacky, zany characters to go on these, like, I'm still in that kind of like heyday where I'm embracing it, and like I might have been doing this for years for, you know, because that's how sad I am. Even if I'm just going to sit in a pool all day on this one drinking beer, that like I'm on the Palm Springs side of rogue, and like that, and I know I appreciate it that it didn't work for you, but that combination of words, roguelike Prince of Persia game from Dead Cell Studio, is gonna get a lot of people rock hard.
See,
and we'll know what it looks like tomorrow, supposedly.
And in your analogy, though, I'm J.K. Simmons. That's how I feel.
Right, you're like the one for, fuck you for dragging me into this. I'm going to like, this is a living hell for me.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
No, I
am.
I don't know. Like, maybe this is the one to convert me, maybe. But I...
No.
I struggled with them.
Yeah.
I even struggled with what's it called? Astronaut Soccer Mum.
Returnal. Returnal was one of the best games of that year.
Exactly, and I really wanted to like it, and I really loved some elements of it, but I just I really struggled. I was like, for God's sake, man, this game.
Returnal was quite punishing, though. Returnal was like one of the more like, I mean, you want to talk? I don't want to get into the weeds on rogue and roguelike and roguelite, but like Returnal was pretty hardcore in its kind of like reading of some of the ways that genre can go and bend or not bend. But yeah, that was my Prince of Persia exclusive, what I will say, I hopefully you can agree on this, if nothing else, and that when to go from laughing at the multiple delays that the Sands of Time remake has suffered to celebrating the fact that we're gonna have like two Prince of Persia games released, because it's apparently also gonna come out in early access in May, right. So we're gonna have two Prince of Persia games released within 6 months. They're going to have different looks on, you know, a once very celebrated franchise. I think that's really neat.
Yeah, no, do you know what it is? And it is nice when a franchise goes from down in the dumps, as you said, to actually looking pretty strong, which is decent. But Jamie, there is some irony.
Oh my God.
What's that?
I need to stop doing on the fly. Reporting, because I'm now looking at Tom Henderson's Twitter profile.
Go on.
And Insider Gaming put out an article an hour ago saying, exclusive, forget everything you know about Prince of Persia Sands of Time remake. So, I mean, I could like read this article out loud and give us our third Prince of Persia news story of the night if you want it.
Yeah, do it.
Okay. First, forget everything you've seen or heard from the real trailer, as the remake has been remade from scratch. So that, I guess
Thank
that's
goodness.
The big headline here. The remake has been remade.
Thank
you. Ubisoft's
goodness.
Official announcement on the change of developers said that Montreal would be, quote, building upon the work already done by Ubisoft Mumbai and Prune. Prune, I presume that's how that's pronounced. But from what we've been able to gather, it's been completely redone. footage sent to Insider Gaming under the condition that it does not go public shows the game is somewhat still in an early stage, brackets missing textures, assets, etc., and is unfortunately likely a ways off from release. Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time remake's overhaul also includes a, quote, more realistic approach, said one source. Everything has been built from the ground up, which includes a complete graphic overhaul, new animations, and mechanics for combat and parkour, and much more. Starting from scratch, well, has meant that the game has been rewritten, recaptured in mocap, and more.
Okay.
One of the more notable changes for longtime Prince of Persia fans is that Yuri Lowenthal, the voice behind the prince in the original, will no longer be reprising his role, despite him doing so in the original reveal trailer and during the remake's original development. It's not entirely clear why Lowenthal is no longer on the project.
So this is like Resi 1 level remake. This is we are going in and doing everything again from the ground up. Everything's different. It's the same game in name alone, basically.
I suppose what's interesting is that would have been a logical pitch for the game when we first heard about it. But for that to be the direction the game is taking when a certain amount of work on the game has already been done, I mean, that's quite significant. The fact that we had that launch trailer, that reveal trailer, that yes, we all took the piss out of, but that's out there. We can still go and watch that trailer on YouTube. And in the background, like, that game has been rewritten, recast, recaptured for mocap, and everything has been rebuilt from the ground up with a graphical overhaul. Like, they clearly, in a kind of Sonic the Movie-esque fashion, took the fan feedback to heart and were like,
they heard us.
Yeah, what the fans are right, and this isn't worth fucking up.
They heard us. I'm glad.
That seems like a win to me. And that also strikes me as a win in that one of the other things I was a little bit concerned about up to this time, and I'd be curious for your take on this because you're the guy, is that this was a Prince of Persia Sands of Time remake. So while it was a throwback to what some see as the peak of the series and that kind of the PS2 era 3D entries and that trilogy of games, really it was like the two sequels, the two follow-up games, whose names escape me.
Warrior Within and the Twin Two Thrones.
They both sound very believable. Thank you. They were the ones that received like real kind of critical acclaim and were where sort of some of the games slightly darker, more, I'm not going to say mature, but edgier sort of tendencies kind of dripped in and the package became a little bit more, you know, it stood out a little bit more and became more of its own thing. And my concern up to this point was, well, is a Sands of Time remake just going to remind people how much they actually liked those two sequels more than the original game? But hearing that this has been completely overhauled and being made from the ground up for like modern conventions almost makes me feel like some of those concerns could be circumvented by the new design they're implementing.
I think so. From memory serves, for me, what kind of happened was the Sands of Time really set the groundwork and showed us a fantastic utilization of those time mechanics of the prints, of the parkour, of the combat, but it had teething problems. Like, so for example, I remember being frustrated about the fact you always had to do a finish them off with the dagger, the time dagger, right? That was and that's just what you did. But then they blew that apart with the sequel and they let you incorporate a bunch more moves. You could decapitate enemies, chop them in half, all stuff like this. And they just like took what they already had in the first one and they just ran with it. I don't think a remake of Sands of Time takes away, or as you said, reminds people that they thought these sequels were better. I think what it does is it sets new groundwork for new sequels. If you just genuinely remade any of those three games and tried to play them again, I think that is rough. Really, really rough.
Right.
Because I've played them in the last couple of years. Like I've gone back and had a play around with those games, and my glasses are seriously rose tinted. and so I'm much more keen on a complete ground up remake. You know, with modern sensibilities, modern ways of playing, a lot of quality of life issues, things that we've got nowadays that can bring their weight to bear. I'm not that keen on out and out remasters or, you know, or too close a remakes to those originals. I'm all for a bit of the special treatment that Resi got.
Yeah, that is, and it's going to be interesting because, of course, if is as well received as the Resi remakes were, then who knows? Maybe the sequels are to follow because of Resi. They're up until 4 now, and there are even people out there who desperately want a 5 remake, which seemed unheard of at some point in time. But the closer you get to it, the more you're like, maybe they do that.
Yeah, well, I guess why not? They're having so much success. Like, yeah, why not?
Right, yeah, why not?
But no, you've pulled it back, Jamie. You sort of killed me off with the idea that there was going to be a roguelike Prince of Persia release announced tomorrow, but you've managed to pull it back, and I'm happy once again. However, you did kind of ruin my segue.
Oh, no. Do you want me to like, go back and rehash a point that I've already made with slightly different wording to give you a new segue?
If you can just say roguelike and Metroidvania a couple of times.
Okay. I just think it's really cool that Prince of Persia is back and on store shelves and exploring these interesting new genres like Metroidvanias and roguelike games.
Well, Jamie, it's funny that you reference roguelike and Metroidvanias, because what if you actually wanted to go back and play the originals? If you wanted to play Rogue, or maybe you wanted to play Metroid, or you wanted to play Castlevania. Up until now, if you wanted to do that on your Apple iPhone, you will have not had been...
Oh, no.
You will not been in much luck. However, times, they are changing, because following after the well-publicized lawsuit that saw Apple... get charged $2 billion from the euros, whoever the euros are that impose these gigantic fines.
That weird union of Europeans.
Those union European types. Apple, they got done, Jamie. They got stitched up a little bit because they were in trouble for non-competition clauses and unfair marketing practices, etc., because they were stopping other companies from selling their wares on the App Store quite in the fashion that they would like. So they've been fined $2 billion. They got a slap on the wrist, and they don't want to incur the wrath of the euros again. So they've sort of made a few tweaks to their terms and policies in the App Store. One of those is that they're now going to make it easier for third-party music streaming services to direct you to external sites. So some people will be really happy about that. But the reason I talk about Metroid, Castlevania, and Rogue is because one of the other things that has changed in the terms and the conditions for the App Store is that until now, it has been something that they have not allowed emulators to be put onto the store for you to emulate old retro consoles specifically. And they've actually now updated the terms of the service with the App Store to say that now developers can put retro game console emulator apps onto the App Store and offer the downloading of games, which is going to be music to the ears of some people out there. Because if you're anything like me, like I think there are so many games that you would have played back in the day that have worked so beautifully on an iPhone, and you could take them wherever you want with you. They're kilobytes, they're tiny games when they're emulated. You could have them, you could play tens of thousands of emulated retro games, and it would be amazing. But Apple won't let you do it, but now they may. So I think this is a pretty phenomenal development for people that are rocking an iPhone, like myself. Android users have been able to use for ages, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. For a long time, at least from the outside looking in, Android has seemed like the wild west for emulation, especially if you're willing to sail the seven seas in the search for new games to play. But I think you were very careful to say that this may end up being great for iPhone users, and I think it's kind of the asterisk that this comes with that really determines just how exciting this is as an iPhone user, certainly as one myself.
Yes, because as you may not be surprised, one thing that Apple have said is that anybody who is uploading emulators to the App Store, I'll give you this specific wording so that we don't get it wrong. They've said that the developer will be responsible for all such software offered in-app, including ensuring that such software complies with the guidelines and all applicable laws. They've also said that the apps must include a method for filtering objectionable material, a mechanism to report content and timely responses to concerns, and the ability to block abusive users. In the article that I was reading as well, it also went on to say that they need to... I couldn't tell if it was like they can't offer in-game purchases either, so they need to make sure that those are being filtered out as well. So it's kind of a weird one, because the asterisk may be that the only people that are allowed to provide these emulators are the companies who own the rights to these games themselves, which obviously starts to get a little bit more iffy as to whether anyone's going to bother making these available or not. Yeah, like, I don't know. If you're Nintendo, do you go ahead and make an iOS app so that people can emulate your old Nintendo SNES games? Do you, to Sega, like, how... I don't see necessarily why they would, but...
No, I don't know why either. I mean, I think really that is the key question in all of this, and in terms of how exciting this actually is and how meaningful, you know, this policy change actually becomes. It's because, you know, like, assuming that Apple police this in the way that one would imagine them to, this requires, as you said, a Nintendo or a PlayStation or a Sega to... Yeah, just, again, those are presumptions based on the kind of the era of consoles we're talking about, that are traditionally emulated, at least based on the kind of the power of the device as possible. Of course, I guess the only other company you'd need to mention would be Microsoft and Xbox. And whilst the OG Xbox is old enough now, it's incredibly difficult to emulate, even on like PC. So I don't think that's going to be of a concern. If any of them want to come forward and make apps that allow you to play some, like, maybe classic games from their past emulated on iOS devices, that could be really cool. But I don't know. They're going to have to be very careful about how they do it, because I think a lot of the times, let's be honest, piracy is a big factor in this conversation, whether you acknowledge it directly or not. Yeah, and a lot of the times, the thing that determines whether or not piracy kind of wins or loses is convenience. And the more inconvenient you make it for someone to get something, the more maybe the more likely they are to pirate it. And I often think the opposite is true. Like, the more convenient and reasonably priced you make a certain service, the less likely people are to pirate. I think there have been plenty of people, I don't know the numbers on this, but I feel like I've experienced it to a certain extent in the last 10 to 15 years, for example, who have found actually like the convenience and the quality of services offered by companies like Netflix, as an example, whilst they have kind of... you know, taking the piss a little bit in as the years rolled by in terms of price increases and so on and so forth. But like, sometimes services like Netflix made it so convenient that when you were like, oh, I can pay however many pounds a month and have access to a massive library of films and TV shows that I would never actually get through, that actually, like, trying to find a version of the Pirate Bay that is still live and opening up my, you know, blowing the dust off my uTorrent or BitTorrent and all that kind of stuff, just felt a little bit old hat. And you're like, most people stopped doing it. Some people didn't, but a lot of people stopped doing it. And it's because the game changed and things became more convenient. And you're one login away from, like, I'm just going to... And that's because the other thing with that stuff was still rooted in downloading at a time where streaming became way more feasible and more convenient than downloading. Why download an entire movie? Why wait half an hour for an entire movie to finish downloading when you can stream it? Like, and so there's a battle for convenience that that might be really uphill for anyone who does want to look into this as a potential venture. I mean that in terms of pricing, like, what is the reasonable way to price something that is like so easy to get for free and very quickly online and already runs on any PC you own in your entire household? So half of these games would run in browsers, let alone natively on the PCs. Like, you just have to make the case for it that you have to make is really tough. And people can be lured into these things.
I can see a user case and see what you think to this.
Yeah.
If it was that easy, if you could literally go into the App Store, download a SNES emulator, and download 500 games right onto your iPhone,
yeah,
your ability to then plug that phone into a television and then have controllers where your multiple people are playing like a game on the television, I think that is one reason why it will never happen. Because Nintendo do not want you to have the ability to have 500 games immediately playable on a device, which means there's no point in you buying a Switch or a Switch 2 or a Switch OLED.
Sure. Or even other things they've made in the past. Like, you don't have to go back that far back to when the NES Classic and the SNES Classic and the PlayStation Classic were like hot ticket items for like,
absolutely, periods. Yeah.
And you open those up and those were like, you know, very basic like boards surrounded, encased in plastic that, you know, that was meant to make us feel nostalgic, a couple of ratty little controllers that weren't that great, and like 10, 15, 20 games that weren't particularly well emulated. Again, like they somehow managed to package and market a product that pulled the wool over a lot of people's eyes in terms of the emulation experiences they could be getting out there. And that is maybe a use case for them, is that once you get into the hundreds of millions of people that you can now access through through iOS, how many of them know about the world of emulation, or and how and are bothered to do that research, and how many of them are on the other side of the equation where you say to them, hey, for 99p you can play Pokemon Red on your phone and it's the real legit version, and they go, oh my god, take my money. There is definitely money to be made in that sense. And I think by picking the right games and targeting the right audiences where there is that kind of nostalgia, especially games that, you know, aren't like, because let's be honest, like they're going to have to create some kind of like virtual controller at the bottom of the screen. You're going to have like a virtual D-pad and virtual buttons that aren't going to feel great because most people still aren't using Bluetooth devices and they're not going to start for this reason. So if you pick the right games and you target the right audiences, there's definitely a group of people out there who Nintendo could, for example, take advantage of with like well-priced and well-placed versions of Super Mario Brothers, Super Mario World, the OG Pokemon games, and so on. But I think other companies and other titles might, you know, be pushing their limits.
I'd be sold on, like, if there was a Midway app or something like that, where you could download, you know, you could play those super old arcade titles that like Midway had back in the 80s and 70s and stuff. I think that would be.
I don't know who owns the rights to all of them now.
No, not me either. I know I like, so Pac-Man and sort of that sort of era. I know Midway then owned the rights, but I don't know who would own the rights to them now. And it's weird as well because it's different across different territories. So like Midway were like certain countries, obviously I think the US, and then you had different company in Japan and things. But yeah, so it would get very complicated, and maybe they'd still need to replicate that because they still own the rights to them. I don't know, but it definitely is an interesting avenue that we haven't apparently had open to us before as iPhone users, and is something that now can be exploited, developed, looked at, all those good things. So keep your eyes open.
Wait and see what these developers do with the opportunity in that space, and how compelling it is. But at the moment, when we're just looking at a legislation change and a change in terms of service, it's kind of hard to know how excited we should be or to let ourselves be about it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there you go. That's all the news that we have got today. Thank you for you, Jamie, introducing a couple of new bits, because otherwise we would have been very light on the ground. I'm glad you found those little cheeky bits from Tom Henderson.
Jensi, don't thank me. Thank the prince.
It's the prince. The prince did it. I'm just going to quickly give a shout out to Ice Try in the chat, because Ice Try popped in just at the end here to say, I was very confused on who or what this channel was. Then I realized it was the former members of All Time Gaming. I missed the shout out of the channel. Glad to see you guys still doing YouTube. And they said there used to be an emulator on the iOS app, on this app store that used to run classic Super Mario Bros. And was pretty sick. Well, maybe they'll bring that back then. Hey, you never know.
Yeah. I wonder if Nintendo knew that existed.
Maybe they'll bring back All Time Gaming. Who knows? Probably not.
Go back to episode 200. Chris is on it. You can really relive the heydays, like we're still trying to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Check that out. You'll enjoy it. But no, thank you, Jamie. Thank you for joining me and being an awesome co-host as ever. Thank you to everyone out there in YouTube land who joined us in the chat. And thank you to our patrons who've gone over to patreon.com/supershow. to support us, and we will be back probably same time, similar time next week for some more gaming news and to give you the lowdown on everything Tom Henderson has found out in the week since. Maybe we'll be talking about the news that does come out tomorrow on the 10th, and about the fact that Prince of Persia has got a brand new roguelike.
Yeah, I think it's a part of a wider show. I can't remember which show it is, but like we said, the run up to the Summer Madness has well and truly begun.
Absolutely. Cheers, everyone. We'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.